warring.
In the Old Testament.
Okay. In 1968, the North Vietnamese then, with their Viet Cong troops as well, attacked 44 cities. They only held one, 26 days, Hue. And it was not a pro-Saigon city, it was an anti-Saigon city. So people in Hue didn't welcome them, but they weren't necessarily afraid. They said, here come these people. Now, when they got in the city, and they had held it securely in that section that was not involved with the fighting any longer, so in a time when there was no gunfire, in that section, the large section of the city they held, they then carried out their political program. They had a clipboard type of listing of people and asked them to come to political re-education courses or political orientation courses, sort of to give them the message on what the revolution is all about. And so many families bid goodbye to members of their family going out to these courses for a brief time, and they never returned. And when you come to the after the removal of the North Vietnamese from the city, U.S. Marines, the U.S. troops, and the South Vietnamese troops liberated the city. Then these people, 5,000, were missing. Sometime around May, a farmer in the ravines outside the city stumbled on a piece of wire sticking out of the ground. And as you would do in that kind of thing, you kind of kick at it because it's almost grabbed your sandal. And you kick it loose, but it comes up out of the ground and a hand, a skeleton-like hand, comes with it. And that was the beginning of the discovery of the bodies. And then the people went out from the city to see where those missing people might have gone. And there the identifications were made and the mass graves were found. And probably by the figures there, 3,000 people, perhaps more, were buried alive, shot in the back of the head or strangled, and they had their hands tied many times with wire behind their back. That was the scene. Now, in the city of Hue, people who were the eyewitnesses on neighborhood blocks, who said, well, they came to the house of my neighbor, would also begin to talk. And this one man said, they came to my neighbor's house, they walked in, they had their board with names on it with them. They identified the people. They shot the grandmother, they shot the grandfather. They shot...
And the thing about the wire, just focusing on that particular image, I think is very effective.
Okay. In 1968.
And I would just add one thing. Occasionally, you look over at the camera
while
you're talking.
Oh, okay. Look it right at you. Okay.
Yes,
it's an irresistible.
No, it's hard not to, really.
Well, it's easier not to. I mean, by that, it's easier on the interview focus and concentration. It's just that the apparatus is there, and I like it.
Okay. Just take your Mariel time.
Stand by. Filled up a little, David, and anytime.
In 1968, when the communists attacked all of the 44 cities of South Vietnam, they only held one, and that was the city of Hue. And they held it for 26 days. And during that time, they came into the city, and the firing had stopped in that part of the city. And it was not liberated till sometime later, after that 27th day, by the U.S. troops and the South Vietnamese troops. But it was very interesting to find that when they came in, they organized an indoctrination or an education program for people. Now, this was a city, Hue, that was opposed to Saigon in domestic politics at many fronts. So people went to these education gatherings, and they were said to be taken by the name within the family. We want you to come with us. And they took them to some unknown location. At the end of the fighting, and when the city was then liberated, 5,000 people were missing in the city, people that had gone out and never come back. In May, a farmer was walking along in a ravine outside the city, and he kicked at a piece of wire that was sort of hanging onto his sandal as he was striding along. And the wire came up out of the ground and bringing with it an arm, a skeletal arm of one of the bodies of the victims of the Hue massacre. That was the beginning of the finding of the bodies. And then they began to identify these people, and they matched the names on the list. Well, then we had further confirmation when some of the neighbors began to talk in their recounting of what happened on their neighborhood block when the communists came for those 26 days. And one of the things that was noted was that this one man said, well, next to me, they came to my neighbor's home. They didn't bother me. They had my neighbor's name on a list, on a clipboard, and they walked in, and they identified the man, and they shot him, and then they shot his wife. And then they shot the grandmother and the grandfather in the house, and then the grandchildren. And then they shot the cook, and then they shot the maid, and then they strangled the cat, and they threw the goldfish on the floor. And he said, I know this because when they left, I went there to see what had happened to my friends. I heard the shooting, and I heard the screams. And when I walked in, even the goldfish was on the floor dying. It was a house of death after they had come. And it was all off of a clipboard. So they killed by a list. They killed politicians, they killed intellectuals, they killed teachers, they killed newspaper people, they killed Buddhists who were opposing the government of Saigon. It was amazing to see them go right through the process of eliminating those whom otherwise they'd have to compete with in time of peace. They were getting ready for what they thought when they first came in was going to be a great victory. The whole Tet attack was predicated on the fact that the Marxist theory said, on that one day when you do charge and attack all the cities, people rise and explode in your favor, and then the war is over. And they failed. And after that, they begin to negotiate in Paris. But the important point was that we later learned all of these names came off that list. That was not a killing by accident or breaking of orders or a commander going berserk, as My Lai was. It was a killing by design of the policy of the people who sent in the troops. So we broadcast to the North a denunciation of them for atrocities. And they broadcast back later that year, there were no atrocities committed in the occupation of Hue. Those were blood debts that we collected, and there are many more to be collected. That's why after the Hue massacre was discovered, the people of Hue wanted an M16 for Christmas. They were no longer neutralists. They were no longer anti-Saigon. They wanted some way to defend themselves. There was no bleacher seat left to sit on.
I wonder if you could, while we're at this, talk about the Hue massacre as perhaps foreshadowing the Holocaust of Cambodia.
Before we go on, just to say, Dolph, one more time, tuck your tie and microphone cord.
Like that?
Yeah, wide.
That should have been an... These events and the kind of precision and policy that would create these events on the part of Hanoi should have warned us that the kinds of events that were to occur later, the re-education centers in South Vietnam, but even more the slaughter in Cambodia, the literal bloodbath that took place there, was part of a Marxist type of belief that this is the way you cleanse society. It also would explain why those boat persons started out of Vietnam fleeing their country for the first time in 4,000 years of their history. They didn't flee with 15 wars with China. They didn't flee with three wars with Kublai Khan. They didn't flee with one war with the French and the Japanese war sandwiched in there, and then the war we were involved with. It was when Hanoi came to rule Saigon. Hanoi achieved from the South Vietnamese the most repugnant in 4,000 years award. Because people said, this is it, we've got to get out of our country, and 1.5 million came to the United States. And more, many more than 50,000 died in the South China Sea trying. That is also testament to the bloody policy of extermination and annihilation of opponents that Hanoi had given us a foreshadowing of in the Hue massacre. And we did not see reporting of that in the United States at all. The media performance on that was not only miserable, it was abominable.
I'd like you to say why you feel that Massacre was non-news. Why wasn't it, start off, the Hue massacre wasn't reported thoroughly because...
Yeah. I think that the problem reporting the Hue massacre for the media was they had already set themselves in the mold of leading the charge to see to it that the United States would get out of Vietnam. Now, if the United States, looking at the thing in 68, the deaths that we had in this country in 68, Martin Luther King's assassination, Robert Kennedy's assassination, the turmoil within the Democratic Party convention, all these events were really saying, enough, Vietnam is something that is pointless. It is a horrible thing for the U.S. to be involved with. There is nothing meritorious about it. Now, if they had to stop and say, but folks, there might be something worse than some of the problems that have occurred in Vietnam, such as the My Lai massacre type of problem, because that was breaking the rules. A U.S.
Okay, now, I'll tell you what, if I could stop you.
Okay.
Just if you could briefly say okay. why the Hue massacre you think was important.
All right. Let me do it again. I'll answer the question. I have to answer.
I want to go on to the My Lai thing.
Right.
That's a separate
okay. Two or three sentences. I think the Hue massacre was overlooked largely by media because it didn't fit the pattern they'd already established. The pattern was the United States creates the problems in Vietnam. And the North Vietnamese are the answer to the problems in Vietnam in the sense that, well, they are Vietnamese. And as J. William Fulbright had said, if we just get out of there and let these Vietnamese get along together and have their decisions made together, why, it'll be a happier time for all concerned. And that was totally ignorant and totally wrong. But it was a media decision or view that had already been presented as the profile of what was happening there. How could they now stop and say, wait a minute, folks, we've just discovered Auschwitz. It's been operating there. Wait a minute, there's something worse than these minor and lesser killings and problems of warfare. There's something of a policy that won't stop once it's instituted. There's that living death of the Soviet slave labor camp type society, and they were just getting a preview of it. And I think that the media was unable to cope with that.
Excellent. I would like to go on now.
Did that sound like a raving fanatic? I don't want to.
That was
a good answer. I'm going to get this wire, whether I tape it to you.
Yes,
or not.
Yeah. It just keeps climbing, huh?
Right.
Well, I tell you, I can tuck it in my trousers. It'll go to my shorts. How about that?
Well, we've been in Charlton Preston shorts. We might as well get in here.
Yeah, there you are. Now, is it? Did it come out okay?
Okay. I want to say something about the My Lai massacre.
See, I'm tied to Huey because I wrote a song about Huey.
I know that. I've heard.
I mean, and that song was the only way we could get on CBS, in the affiliate here, with any mention of that after the events had been spot news covered. And they covered the burning of a North Vietnamese flag and the singing of that song on the steps of the Capitol by the students.
About writing this, why he wrote the song.
All right. I was so frustrated that by the non-media coverage of the Huey massacre after the spot news coverage of just the event. Yes, there had been a massacre. Yes, they're looking at some bodies. And the significance escaping the media coverage, the national media coverage, that I finally wrote a song for some people who were going to burn the North Vietnamese flag on the steps of the U.S. Capitol and protest the Huey massacre and the North Vietnamese policy. And the song was called Voices of the Dead. And I did that, and it did get coverage on the CBS affiliate here in Washington, D.C., because it had that other approach. It sneaked by because they said, well, this is a song, and these are students, and they are singing this song, so we have to cover that. That's a good feature. It's almost like a kicker to a news story. But imagine an event like that. It would be like you would have to write a song about Dachau or Belsen or Buchenwald or Auschwitz in order to get the story covered completely and three-dimensionally by the press of the world. Well, everyone knows that that was a major story and dominated everything, including up to today when we think of the Holocaust. Well, there was a Holocaust preview in Hue, and all the evidence was there, and the North Vietnamese incriminating words, these were blood debts, and the media missed it. So if you have to turn to song and poetry, I guess that's what you have to do. But at that time, it did work and get some attention. But the song was called Voices of the Dead because, well, the last verse said, for the sake of the future, hear the voices of the dead. You see? And that was the last refrain of the song. And that was an appeal to people, including media. Don't pass over this loss of human life because it's a policy that you're seeing in action. And the policy is going to write the history of, I think one line in there, but remember, dear neighbor, if now you turn and run, then the future will be written by the executioner's gun. And I'm proud that I got that prophetic line in there. When I saw the boat people come later, I felt at least I had tried to warn people here and to awaken the media here. I'm not saying that the song ever got on the bestseller list, but it was out there. It is part of history. It is now in the Library of Congress in the audiovisual section, that audio history section.
Let's go back to the My Lai massacre as something that was done in the heat of battle by a young officer and so on in a setting which things were not planned, as opposed to the deliberate assassinations of Huey. And if you could
try to contrast. Okay. Well, it is a case because.
Well, let's start now.
Okay.
With some sort of thing, the Huey massacre and the My Lai massacre.
It would probably be helpful to look at the comparison of the Huey massacre and the My Lai massacre.
Okay, why don't you start? With
okay.
That.
It would probably be helpful at this point to just spend a few minutes looking at the Huey massacre as compared to the My Lai massacre. The Huey massacre was policy by the North Vietnamese.
Could you just start over and don't put in a few minutes? That's the lecture style.
Okay, all right. It would probably
tell me
be,
what it is.
Okay. It would probably be helpful to look at the Hue massacre and compare it to the My Lai massacre. The Hue massacre was policy of the North Vietnamese government, the North Vietnamese general staff, and the North Vietnamese political leadership of the army in South Vietnam. So all the North Vietnamese troops were on that same policy line. Kill those with whom we might have to compete later when peace comes. Now, the My Lai massacre was a breaking of all the rules of the American forces in Vietnam, all the rules of conduct that each GI carried on a little card in his pocket when he was there. Now, it was then shabby cover-up attempt that really drew more attention to it. So the United States Army made great mistakes in the command level trying to cover up something, but notice, you cover up something that wasn't supposed to happen. You cover up something that's a breaking of the rules. But it does show the policy of the United States was not to have it happen. It was that it was a reaction, and I think a wrong reaction, to try to cover it up. Now, there you have the contrast of one policy that was proudly taken credit for by Hanoi. We collected blood debts. There are more blood debts to be collected. Imagine if the U.S. Army had said at the time, yes, we killed those people in My Lai, and wherever we go into villages, we're going to kill more people. Then there would have been true outrage in this country. Well, why wasn't there outrage when North Vietnam said essentially the same thing, and when the victims surviving kin said the same thing in Hue? There was just no attention paid. We were too busy. We were moving on the American focus of the American war in Vietnam. And that was only one dimension of a three-dimensional problem. And if you were in journalism school and you missed that kind of story in a hypothetical situation in the classroom, you flunk.
You know, when we talked about this earlier, you used the word racist. And maybe go back and say this contrast again.
Okay, I'll cover myself with this one.
Some Americans do things wrong.
Okay, some people have even tried to approach this from perhaps the American media's weakness or vulnerability to a racist kind of judgment. Namely, when Americans are involved in an action, it becomes important. When Vietnamese are committing atrocities against Vietnamese on a massive scale, on a policy scale, like North Vietnam did to the city of Hue's inhabitants, that's just a Vietnamese matter. And after all, who are the Vietnamese? Not nearly as important as the Americans. Now today, it's very ironic that in the boat persons who have come here, they have the highest SAT scores for pre-college preparation of any group in the United States. So that we didn't get a people who were the dregs of humanity or people inferior in any way. We are getting the future people who are going to be outstanding in the leadership fields in this country, but we got them by a tragedy that didn't have to occur. And so in some ways, on all sides, the theory that only Americans were important is disproved, past, present, and future.
Okay, I want to turn to this photograph, and what I'd like you to lead in with is something in April of 1975, the Associated Press distributed a photograph to its subscribers, and for use with Vietnam preparedness stories was the label. And you know, I don't have. You may hold it if you wish.
It's white. You really should hold it.
But you might want to just refresh your memory.
Yes, I have seen that photograph, and I was shocked by that little slug line on the top about hold for.
In April of 1975.
Okay. In April of 1975, South Vietnam, about the 22nd day of April, that is dated, South Vietnam was in the process of collapse. And so it's interesting that they were trying to say, by that photo, hold this, because we will now indicate that the Vietnamese could not make it. The South Vietnamese could not defend themselves after all the effort we made for them. What it doesn't convey is that the U.S. Congress cut the funds to the South Vietnamese Army starting in 74 down to 10% of what was given the Vietnamese Army when American troops were also in the country. But we'd withdrawn all our troops by that time of 75. Now, the other conclusion that comes across is the editor probably by that slug line was referring to run this picture to show that there was nothing worthwhile in Vietnam. All there was death and this atrocity by the American troops. And now it's all collapsing. So for what purpose did all of this great horror take place? Hold for Vietnamese preparedness story. Now, if the editor did mean, wait a minute, We now see the action of the Congress in cutting the funds have cut the Vietnamese army off at the knees. So obviously they're not going to win the marathon. They're going to run poorly in terms of defending themselves. And now we have to think about a picture like people in this gully in My Lai, but let's not say My Lai, let's just say atrocities, and call attention to the fact that if the North wins, maybe the policies we saw in the Hue massacre will be the policies for the Vietnamese to endure after that northern flag goes up in Saigon. I don't think that was the editor's purpose, because I didn't see that kind of view coming out of the national media. But it's very significant that in print you have something which shows that even there they were trying to keep the continuity and the consistency. There was nothing worthwhile anyway, and the South Vietnamese couldn't make it on their own even when we'd given them that tremendous effort for all those years. And all of those statements are false.
Okay. Dolph, I think I have one more question I want to put to you. Could you say something about your experience of TAT? You were in the White House at this point, were you not?
Yes.
And perhaps the difference of your perception of what was going on versus the general public.
It was a very frustrating.
During TED,
I was attached to the National Security Council staff on loan. And it was very frustrating to be there because Dr. Walt Rostow would take to the president the material showing him that there had been great losses on the part of the North Vietnamese forces and the Viet Cong. In fact, what was discovered quite early, there was no plan for retreat or reinforcement of the South Vietnamese communist forces brought up from the Delta and from the villages where they'd been all those years. They'd burned their camps before they left. They believed the poem Ho had written 25 days before the attack, saying, "Now we rise, one day all Vietnamese rise." But the people didn't respond to greet them or to embrace them or to support them. So they couldn't find their way out of the city, and they had no plan for reinforcement and no plan for retreat, and they died. Really, we begin to see that the North Vietnamese had, by design or by the disappointment of their hopes, crippled the entire village protection forces of the Viet Cong. So we, in the next year, were able to get into 1,000 more villages with the programs of social, economic, and political, including the election process. In 1,000 more villages, we already had been with the South Vietnamese effort, 1,000 villages had held elections in 1967. There were only 2,300 villages in the whole country. It meant that the communist forces had been crippled. And that's why North Vietnam negotiated in May. However, as Dr. Rostow would take this information to the president, the president would also be watching the evening news on three television monitors at the same time. And they would all say the same thing. It's hopeless. It's over. No nation can go through such a crushing defeat as this and still claim that they have a policy or a purpose in Vietnam. And then facing President Johnson was the decision, shall I run again? So it was one of those incredible moments to see where you had information, and we, by the way, gave this information to Congress. And we sought in every way to say, to let them see the reports. Here's how the Viet Cong have been crippled. Here's the northern Vietnamese being defeated in these different cities. Here are the people of Saigon not embracing them, the people of all these cities not rushing to join them. We have a new moment coming in Vietnam. The enemy will be crippled. Now, the person that confirmed this most deeply was Mao Tse-tung, because Mao Tse-tung had as his love child the Liberation Front, and he was furious with the fact that North Vietnam had sacrificed the Liberation Front on the altar of the North Vietnamese policy. And now the Liberation Front was in shambles, and he wanted the North to negotiate with the United States and get the United States out and get the North out. It was very impressive that Mao Tse-tung felt that the real purpose of his struggle was the Liberation Front, and the Liberation Front was now in shambles. It had been just a front anyway, just a mask. But Mao wanted it to become real because that was his policy. And he was in a great quarrel with Moscow. And he had to be right, and Moscow had to be wrong. And Moscow supported everything Hanoi did. But there at the White House, with all this information pouring in, you couldn't get it across to the American people because the media kept saying exactly the opposite. It's over, it's pointless, it's hopeless, and we have been defeated. And not in any city were we defeated, nor were the South Vietnamese. And the irony was the Congress was getting the information, but they again would be saying, I get all the letters from my constituents who listen to the media, and they say, it's over, it's hopeless. Now, I guess we're just in the stage of a total disaster. So Lyndon Johnson left the presidency a very unhappy man because he knew what was happening But he couldn't communicate. And you notice, as he said, I withdraw and I'm not going to run again, he said, I have split the country. The country has been split. And he put this in such a way, I couldn't get this over to the people. Well, that was the frustration showing through. And that surprised everyone. We did not know he was going to make that addition to his speech that night. But what he was really saying is, the media messed it up. And I can't, at this point, get that across to the American people. Because if the media had told the people what I have in this information, then you'd know that as you go through the year of 68, things would get better. Now, what else drove him out in terms of why didn't he wait through 68? You're talking about Lyndon Baines Johnson, human typhoon and tornado. So this man had his own, he kept his own counsel. But he knew, and what Dr. Rostow knew, and brought him many evidences of, yes, it's bad. It has been a psychological blow. It has been a military disaster for North Vietnam. And by the end of that summer, it was true. We were in 1,000 villages we had never been in before, and there were only 300 villages then in the hands of what was left of the Viet Cong, and then the North Vietnamese talk at Paris while they rebuild and get ready to fight in Vietnam. And then Richard Nixon was the president.
Okay, there's portions of that which I think
Just take part out. I wanted to put enough in, though, because you might be able to pull a line out somewhere. I don't know whether you want the Mao Zedong stuff in that introduces new stuff, but the truth was that Mao with Nixon was advocating to the North very early, get out of Vietnam immediately. Nixon hasn't trained the South Vietnamese, and Johnson didn't train them. Johnson never gave M16s to the South Vietnamese. See, now, when... Oh, okay. But I point that out because later that shows that one group swayed the North not to listen to the advice of Mao Zedong, the peace movement. Convinced the North they could gamble.
Let me stop you, please.
They could gamble. See?
I'd love to listen to you, but we're in a time constraint here.
Yeah.
What I would like you to speak to now is the final thing, which is if there's a single lesson about media and foreign policy that comes out of the Tet Offensive, what is it? And begin your response by saying if there's a single lesson.
Right. If there's a single lesson that comes out of this, it is that you have to have people on the scene in the media covering the events who know deeply the history and the traditions and the forces in the country that they're covering before the battle begins, before such an offensive begins. Because those reporters would see instantly that there was no way for Viet Cong to get out of a city once they came in. No retreat plans, no reinforcement plans, highly unusual. They would have spotted it. But if you have reporters who are really attracted to the pyrotechnics of it, they have to supply New York with those pictures of the streets of Saigon full of ambulances rushing to and fro, full of troops that are firing, and of course taking great personal risks. You're consumed in that. You have no way to get the perspective of the story. 26 men break a hole in the wall of the American Embassy compound, and they don't get past three Marines on the door. There were only three Marines guarding the American Embassy at the outset. They didn't get past those three Marines. But it was reported by networks that they had broken into the embassy. They were on the third floor. They were on the eighth floor, and there was never retractions. You see, I'm saying if you had people then who had such a knowledge of Vietnam who were there for that reason, then we wouldn't have had that kind of reporting of just the pyrotechnics, just the factor of the battle and the bullets whizzing over and the columns of smoke rising to the sky. And that in the future will probably be media's new assignment. Get people trained before the events. If you're going to cover Central America, then have a bureau there. They didn't have a bureau in Central America for the major television networks till summer of 1983. Oh, well, it's late, you see? So it's this message that should have been this lesson that should have been learned, and obviously in the latest crisis that we see closer to our shores, it hasn't been learned. But media, whether it takes a little reminding, whether they need a Head Start program or whatever on this point, they have to send in reporters who can stand back and say, well, I'll tell you, back in New York, it is attractive to cover the fighting in the sense of what it comes out on the film, but that isn't the story. The story is a little more complex, a little more human than that in terms of the events and what's at stake here. And that was not available in Saigon at that time. And as more reporters poured in, 300 journalists were there. As more poured in, they poured in for the sensation that was going on. And that's when you lose all trend and all thread of the significance and the deeper events moving under the sea. I think it's sort of like covering volcanoes. When they erupt, you can't get near them. They're too dangerous. And before they erupt, you can't see what's going on because all the action is underground. Well, you have to have people then who are volcanologists. And the media doesn't have this, or did not have this in Vietnam. I hope they have it in future situations like this. The national media I'm referring to. And I would hope television, with its extra role, would balance the pictures with equally significant comment and insight that would make the pictures play their role of the one dimension they represent, not the whole story. Vietnam was not personified by